Hello, once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
Thank you for tuning in. This week is episode 9 of our Disney bracket, featuring 101 Dalmatians
versus
Emperor's New Groove. This was an interesting matchup.
Yeah, both of these films were really good, but in very different ways. And our job here is to figure out which of those ways is more important.
At least us.
Yeah.
Well, let's go ahead and get into the synopses. 101 Dalmatians. Pongo and his pet human Roger are bachelors in London. Pongo is bored with this and decides to find spouses for Roger and himself. Pongo spouts the perfect pair for them and drags Roger to the park. And after some playful pranks, Roger and Anita marry. So do Pongo and Perdita. Perdita soon after gives birth to 15 puppies. And literature's most unsubtly named character, Cruella de Vil, offers to buy them. Roger stands his ground and says the pups are not for sale. Angered, Cruella hires two incompetent crooks to kidnap the puppies while the dog and human couples are out. The human police are no use in finding the missing litter, so Pongo uses the Twilight Bark to ask if any other dogs have information. The news eventually makes it to the Colonel, Captain, and Sergeant Tibbs. The regiment finds the kidnapped puppies at Hell Hall, the abandoned DeVille ancestral home, along with 84 other Dalmatian pups that Cruella intends to have skinned to make fur coats. They send word back to London that the puppies have been found, and while Pongo and Purdy make their way to the country, the Colonel and Sergeant Tibbs mount a rescue attempt. All 99 puppies escape, and Pongo and Purdy guide them back to home in London, hiding from Cruella and her goons with the support of other animals. Eventually, the Dalmatians make it to a truck heading for London. Cruella and the goons give chase, but run themselves off the road. The Dalmatians make it home safe, and Roger and Anita decide to adopt all the other puppies. Everyone gets warm fuzzies.
Meanwhile, in Emperor's New Groove, released the same year as Final Destination, Emperor Cruzco has it all, and everyone has to put up with it, including friendly neighborhood Pacha, whose village, despite his protests, is soon to be bulldozed for Cruzco's new theme park. When Cruzco fires his transparently evil advisor, Yzma, she plots to poison him, but her incompetent assistant turns him into a llama instead, and he winds up in a sack in Pacha's cart. Pacha is trying to find the courage to tell his wife the bad news when Cruzco wakes up, assumes Pacha kidnapped him, and refuses his help getting home. Cruzco then angers every single living thing in the jungle. Pacha rescues him, anyway. Cruzco slowly learns to be a better person. After a series of misadventures, they wind up back at Yzma's secret lab, not the one that made Dinosaur. Cruzco manages to turn back into a person, Yzma turns into a cat, and all is well. Cruzco makes amends, and agrees to build his theme park elsewhere.
I know we got the summaries down, like, pretty tight, but I don't think either of these movies felt padded. They have relatively simple plots, but I think they execute them very well.
Agreed. There's definitely some padding here and there, and that's a decent jumping off point for 101 Dalmatians, but where there is padding, I don't mind too much. It's usually not too long, and usually still fun to watch. With 101, there's a few scenes of the dogs watching TV that could have been, like, 30 seconds shorter. The Twilight Bark sequence is fun, but it goes on maybe a minute or two longer than it needs to. It's not bad. I don't really mind. I also haven't seen this movie in a long time, so I didn't know where the Twilight Bark was going. If I knew why it was important, I might not have minded them taking as much time on it as they did.
It could have been much worse. There were 3 or 4 songs that were originally written for the movie that didn't make it in. Originally, there was a song that the puppies would sing after they escaped Cruella. There was a song that Jasper and Horace were going to sing in Hell Hall. I think there were 1 or 2 others. I'm glad they were cut. I don't think they were needed here. And I think adding in too many songs kind of detracts from some of the more serious tones that the film has.
All the songs in here are diegetic, aren't they? They're not so much musical numbers as they are characters singing songs that are plot relevant.
With the exception of the Canine Crunchies jingle, yes. And that's just a television commercial.
Right, so it's still definitely part of the plot.
Mm-hmm. The 2 songs that are there are actually really great. So, a change from the original book, instead of the original human male character in the book being a quote-unquote financial wizard, here we have Roger, who is a aspiring musician. And during the course of the film, he writes a song about Cruella de Vil.
It's pretty rare for the villain not to describe himself, but I think it really works here because it's part of Roger's whole thing of trying to get Anita to realize that Cruella de Vil's a jackass.
I identify so strongly with Roger because of that. As someone who has been in a similar situation, trying to get the person you love to maybe reconsider their friendships with a few people, it can be exhausting when they don't listen.
And I'll admit, apart from the whole skinning puppies thing and smoking in someone's house thing and putting your cigarette out in someone's cupcake thing and driving really badly thing and hiring incompetent criminals thing and everything else, Cruella is a fun person, but I get why you wouldn't want her around. I kept remembering things she was doing and like, oh, she's not that fun of a person, even ignoring that. However, as a character, as a villain, she's great. She's incredibly over the top. The way she is drastically thin, but her fur coats make her so huge that she takes up the entire screen is a really good visual gag.
Oh yeah, the gaunt look that she has is works really well with her character. Even the cigarette that she smokes is part of her character. I don't think we ever see her without it. We see a couple other characters smoking, whether they're pipes or a cigar, but their smoke is always like this white, grayish color, whereas Cruella's is always this sickly yellow color that is animated entirely differently. The smoke is a part of her character design, and it works really well.
She literally has a cloud of toxic gas that lingers after she's gone, making things worse. It's a really great visual translation of a character's personality. Speaking of visual translation to people's personality, you get some really fun stuff in this movie where humans will look like their pets, and there's that visual resonance, and it's a kind of fun use of the unlimited plane of animation to have bigger caricatures with people than you might necessarily be able to achieve in real life, like having a woman with a poodle have a coat that has the same type of fur lining that a poodle has.
Really, a lot of the character design in this film is really good. They also nail the dog body language. You see a lot of different emotions from the various animals throughout the film, and they're all conveyed superbly with their body language and the arching of backs, ruffling of fur, baring of teeth.
Pongo especially gets to smile or be sad a lot, and it still feels like it's with a dog face, not like they're putting a human expression on a dog. They're just showing a dog expressing happiness or sadness the way dogs do.
Yeah, if you're familiar with that dopey dog grin, the way they use that on Pongo is great.
It helps that Pongo is kind of a character who would have that dopey dog grin a lot. You also have a lot of great noses in this. I know it's kind of a weird thing to notice, but like Roger and to a certain extent Jasper and Horace all have these kind of large pronounced noses, and it's fun.
And they do a little bit of that with some of the background women along with Anita and Cruella. They actually do have quite a bit of variance with facial features and things like noses, cheekbones, stuff like that. So I definitely give them props for having that sort of variety in female body types that we unfortunately don't get to see that often in animation.
Speaking of props, a great thing this movie does is to fill the background with a lot of detail and variety, but then wash it all down to a pretty similar set of colors. So it's noisy but not loud. So you might have trash cans and street signs and chimneys and gutters, but they're all in the background and they're all the same kind of periwinkle and brown. So you don't really notice them unless you're pausing to look at it. But then you do and you realize how much work was put into every single background. Houses are full of objects and books, or Hell Hall is dilapidated in all these different interesting ways with all this broken furniture, etc.
There's a number of establishing shots in this film that if you just take a frame of, they look like gorgeous landscape paintings that I could definitely see hanging up in someone's home.
You could put them in a frame, you could put them on a Magic the Gathering card.
Yes.
You could tap basically any shot of Hell Hall for a lot of swamp mana.
I do not disagree. There's also just some really interesting design choices going on with a lot of the characters. They feel like they're coming out of a late 50s, early 60s fashion magazine. That whole aesthetic really works well here, especially with Cruella's connections to fashion. And when the movie was released in 61, we were just a few years away from the UK getting really into mod fashion.
This was the first Disney movie that was set in the time period it was released, more or less, wasn't it?
That's correct.
And they capture that late 50s London really well.
Mm-hmm. It's very evocative of that place and that time period. Another interesting thing is that here we're starting to get just a little bit of that line sketchiness that we see in other Disney films later in this decade and into the 70s as well. That's due to this film being the first feature-length animation at Disney that used a Xeroxing technique to copy lines instead of hand-inking them. So you can kind of see the evolution starting here and then taking a look at, say, Jungle Book, which we watched a few episodes back, and seeing the evolution of that sketchy style.
And that Xeroxing allowed them to save on a lot of time and cost of production. It does result in a few repeated animation things, but it's only there if you're looking for it, and it doesn't bother me too much. I mean, you might as well save on that a little bit where you can. I think I've noticed a lot when Disney reuses characters, or at least body shapes, or you might see some of the dogs from Lady and the Tramp in here. It kind of feels like the way some movies will have cameos from famous actors and things, and it doesn't feel lazy. It feels like they're creating a coherent artistic universe.
Yeah, there's definitely a few characters that if you have recently watched Lady and the Tramp, you'll be able to pick out. They do a good job of hiding the main dog characters from that film, though. But no, I don't necessarily mind it here. It's kind of like a nice little callback and Easter egg for those people who are paying really close attention. A thing I do have to kind of give a little bit of criticism for is there's a lot of British slang being thrown throughout the film, especially by Jasper and Horace, and it's British slang from the early 60s, so it can be a little bit hard to follow exactly what they're trying to say at times.
Luckily, during my childhood, there was a phase where I watched nothing but Are You Being Served and Allo Allo and Keeping Up Appearances and things like that, which are all Britcom from the 60s and 70s. So all that was like, oh yes, I know what they're saying perfectly. I speak this language.
Speaking of British television, there's a lot of use of television in the story. The puppies watch a Lassie-esque show about a German shepherd named Thunderbolt. And then there's also a British game show that Jasper and Horace watch called
What's My Crime?
And those little kind of cutaways away from the plot are, while not necessarily needed, I think they add a lot of character and levity.
And the What's My Crime sequence, which is amazing because it's just, you get time off your crime if people can guess what your weird crime was.
It's not that you get time off your crime, it's that you get a vacation after you serve your time.
Oh my god. So that's happening, and it's hilarious, and it's very exaggerated and fun and very British, while a very tense scene of characters sneaking around is happening. And so it's a great way to diffuse a bit of the tension, make it a little more kid-friendly, but also have some really great humor happening to drag out that tension, because there is clearly going to be a point at the end of this sequence, you can tell when that's coming, and it's functionally a ticking clock that doesn't look like a ticking clock, and that was a really brilliant bit of writing.
There's also the fact that during that scene, the criminal whose crime is being guessed by the panel of judges is an acquaintance of Jasper and Horace, and it really does a good job of establishing just how much of incompetent criminals these guys are.
God, there's so much incompetent crime in this, and I love incompetent crime. Speaking of competent, you know who is competent? Nanny. Nanny is great.
Nanny is a great character. She fights tooth and nail to save the puppies when Jasper and Horace invade her home.
I will admit that Roger and Anita having a nanny raises a few questions. I'm not quite sure where they're getting the money from.
Roger and Anita are much less bougie than the the Dearleys from the original book, so I'm really not going to fault Disney.
Aren't they, like, tax exempt because the Roger analog fixed the British national debt?
Yes. And they have two nannies, Nanny Cook and Nanny Butler. Yeah, I really like that they brought the class of the human characters down a little bit for this. It feels more accessible that way.
There is definitely a working class versus upper class vibe. Cruella is definitely old money. She's into furs as a fashion thing, which is a very upper class thing, and is not just with Roger and Anita, who seem like, you know, relatively middle class people. You also have a lot of the dogs living out on farms and the cows in one of those farms all working together as a community to get these puppies home. And it's a really good community-driven justice thing. I like that a lot.
Part of me kind of wanted to talk about maybe some of the parallels you can draw with this film with, say, the refugee crisis or human trafficking. But unfortunately, I really wasn't able to find any sort of inclination of authorial intent with those sorts of parallels. And considering how bougie the original work is, I think they are just kind of there accidentally as opposed to intentionally.
But I think that you were thinking of it is a good sign. It definitely has applicability in that the civilian justice are useless. You have to have a community that works together, even with disparate people all pitching in to get people home. This movie also has the best cat in the Disney animated canon.
Oh yeah, Sergeant Tibbs is awesome. The fact that he is usually the brains behind the operation and the colonel is just a figurehead, I enjoy that dynamic quite a bit.
Because of the way he's drawn, he's clearly very afraid and clearly doesn't want to be doing this. He wants to be sitting somewhere warm with a plate of milk, but is still stepping up, and I'm really into that.
So, there's the character, one of the puppies from Pongo and Purdy is named Rolly. There's a couple fat jokes that get tossed around a little bit. They're not super egregious, but pretty much Rolly's only lines are,
I'm hungry, Mother. I really am.
And the traditional fat character getting stuck in a hole and that creates more tension and drama thing. It's not the worst, but it definitely could not be there.
Although, to kind of counteract it, we do have Horace, who is the stouter of the two crooks.
Yeah, you have the fat one and the tall one. That's how it works.
Yeah. And Horace, continually while searching for the puppies, posits these things that...
But what if they went down the froze-up creek so's not to leave their tracks?
Or...
Jasper, do you suppose they disguise themselves?
Jasper constantly tells him...
Oh, Horace, you idiot. Dogs ain't that smart.
And every single time, Horace is correct in what the dogs are doing.
It is a really fun subversion of the tall and smart, fat and dumb thing.
There is also the nice thing where we have gender equity when Pongo and Purdy both go to save the puppies and bring them home.
You know, I hadn't thought about it, but it would have been so easy to do a, oh no, stay here, Mom, I'm gonna go save the puppies on my own. You take care of the humans.
Especially since we get some really great moments between Purdy and her kids, because that she's along and we get to see her nurturing nature, making sure all the kids are all right. And we also get some of that from Pongo. Really, the family dynamics with all the Dalmatians are great.
I'd also 100% watch an ongoing series about the Dogs of London solving crimes, like Air Bond or whatever. There is a bit where Pongo is trying to pick a future bride for Roger, and he's sort of judging the ladies out the streets, and it's not the best, but it's a lot better than it could have been. They managed to dodge a lot of bullets with that. Like, the worst thing is there's a person who looks kind of nerdy, and it's like, oh, she looks a bit weird. And it's a little, but it's not too bad. I've seen worse variants of that joke in modern things.
Let's go ahead and move on to Emperor's New Groove.
Very tonally different.
Yes.
Where 101 Dalmatians is pretty sincere and straightforward and earnest, this is very tongue-in-cheek, very meta.
They do not care about breaking that fourth wall at all in this film.
Which, honestly, I liked it a lot. I think it's one of the stronger parts of the narrative that they're very self-aware, and it pays off really well because we start with Cusco as the narrator saying, wow, this is all other people's fault. Look at all these things that happened to me. And then he shows us how he got to the point where he is, and he's narrating, and then the Cusco on screen starts arguing with the narrator saying, hey, no, they just saw all of it. You're wrong. This is not their fault. This is my fault. I got myself here. And the narrator just kind of buggers off while Cusco feels sad and needs grass. Usually the narrator doesn't interact too much with the cast, and that's a really good use of an interactive narrator there.
It's actually interesting, because they've used interactive narrators before a little bit. Came up in Hercules.
Yeah. Also a pretty meta film.
Although I definitely think it works better here than it did there.
It's also very consistent. Everybody is on the meta train, apart from maybe Pacha, whereas in Hercules it's mostly the Muses and Hades a little bit, whereas Hercules and Phil don't get to break the fourth wall as much.
And some of the gags that come from the movie just not caring about the fourth wall are great. There's a chase scene about two-thirds of the way through the film, and they're cutting back and forth to a map representation, and you can see, you know, the dotted lines of the path that both sides are taking. And it then cuts back to Yzma and Kronk, and they look down and they see the red dotted line as they're running, and then Kronk looks behind them and sees the purple dotted line.
And they look at each other and just shrug and keep going.
So there's some gags like that that work, although there's some that don't. There's the scene where they zoom out and they kind of keep zooming out and then they get too far and you see this chimp eat a bug. They call it a chimp. It's obviously a monkey. It has a tail, and chimps are not indigenous to South America. But you see a monkey eat a bug, and Cusco's narrating. It's like, what's going on? Why are we doing this? I don't think it's quite funny enough. Eh.
Different strokes, I don't mind it, and it kind of allows them to jump cut from one bit of action to another bit of action where the stuff in the middle would not have been interesting and we needed something to get us there. It's functional, they probably could have put something funnier there to get us to the point. You also have a lot of trope subversion. There is a bit where Yzma is headed to her secret lab, she tells Kronk to pull the lever, and he pulls the wrong lever, and we smash cut to her slapping an alligator and saying, why do we even have that lever? And so you're like, okay. Down the line, there's going to be a point at which Cusco and or John Goodman are going to have to fight the alligators. We get to the point where they pull the wrong lever, smash cut to Cusco slapping the alligator saying, why does she even have that lever? And it just keeps going.
This film understands its humor and comedic timing incredibly well, and 9 out of 10 jokes land.
The humor and the setting have a complicated relationship, and that is a quandary with this film, in that it is ostensibly set in historical Peru, but it doesn't necessarily use that. Originally, this was going to be a very different movie. The plan at first was for it to be a high epic drama akin to, say, Hercules or Moana, in that it would have gods at play, and Yzma was going to summon a dark deity to allow her to blot out the sun because it was giving her too many wrinkles, etc. And there is all this magic and mysticism happening, a few other subplots, and Cusco had a love interest, etc. They stripped a lot of that down, and at one point in the production process, they were like, do we need it to be in Peru? Could we set it in Nebraska and have them all be sheep instead of llamas? And they're right. The story more or less works anywhere you put it. You could put it in Nebraska, you could put it in Russia, in Australia, and the story would play out about the same.
You'd only really need to probably change the animal that Cusco, probably renamed in another location, turns into.
There's a sequence where the characters wind up at a diner, like Greasy Spoon, Three Calendar on the Wall Diner. And as far as I know, Greasy Spoon, Three Calendar diners were not common in pre-contact South America. So they clearly don't really care about the setting that much.
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that. You have similar things in Agrabah or in Thebes in Hercules. There's the guy who has a trench coat, it's like, want to buy a sundial?
Oh, sure. But I mean, they're not trying to accurately represent a particular time period. The way that, say, Pocahontas and Mulan tried.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
There's also some issues that I kind of had with the film. This story is inherently about characters who are from South America, but there isn't a single Latinx person in the voice cast.
And the voice cast is really, really good. You've got John Goodman, Eartha Kitt, Patrick Warburton, and David Spade.
All of them play their roles really, really well. They were all great casting choices. I'm not trying to argue that, but it does feel a little disingenuous to this culture to not try and include at least someone at the table. It's actually surprising. I was doing a little bit of research to see what the Latinx community kind of thought of this. I'm not sure if the movie is old enough where the cultural criticism of that sort of whitewashing wasn't a bigger issue like it is today, or whether most of that dialogue is happening in a non-English language, and I'm not able to find it. But it was a little surprising to me that very few people were raising a stink about this.
Because the film is so abstract from reality, people may wind up just not being as perturbed about it. And the voice cast admittedly are all on top of their game. John Goodman is everybody's dad, and that's great. But also, Eartha Kitt is having the time of her life. Every line she has is golden.
Patrick Warburton is playing his typecast role of surprisingly multifaceted meathead. And you have David Spade playing almost every character David Spade's ever played of the egotistical jerk. Another interesting thing is how well Cusco and Yzma play off each other as foils. They are almost the exact same character. At least before Cusco has his change of heart, they are both only concerned with their own well-being. They are manipulative. They will do whatever they need to get what they want, and anyone in their way be damned. There's also the fact that most of their problems are self-imposed. Whenever Cusco runs into an issue, it's because he caused it himself. He gets turned to a llama because he fired Yzma. He gets attacked by the jaguars because he was mean to the squirrel. He has to walk 4 days to get back to the palace because he broke the bridge going back to Taunt Pacha. So on and so on and so on.
Whereas, sure, Yzma got fired, but also she has nigh unlimited magical powers. She didn't really need a job. And so all of her problems were caused by her trying to poison Cusco and take over the empire. Her being stuck as a cat and not being a human was caused by her getting too angry and tossing the bottle of human juice at the wall and it falls. Also leads to one of the best meta gags here. The bottle is falling, Yzma is falling now, and we smash cut to the ground far below where a guy's saying,
"For the last time, we did not order a giant trampoline. You know, pal, you could have told me that before I set it up."
And then the bottle and the cat bounce off the trampoline and get right back up to where they were before. It's yet more great comedy.
I also really like how they set up Kronk's redemption arc, almost the exact moment that we meet him. You especially see this when he is attempting to throw Cusco over the waterfall. He has this moral conflict, and we get to see his little shoulder devil and shoulder angel,
who are about as level-headed as he is.
And we see that he's not able to go through with it. Even while Kronk is helping Yzma find Cusco, he is doing good. He is consoling this squirrel that is having a really rough day because of the humans. He takes over for the diner kitchen when the chef leaves, and he plays with Pacha and Cheech's kids while Yzma is trying to find out where Pacha and Cusco are.
I feel bad for not mentioning Chicha in my summary. She's really great. Pacha's whole family is great. The kids are funny. Chicha's funny. Their camaraderie is great. Chicha's also pregnant in this, but it doesn't really come up. It's just she just happens to be pregnant. There's not like, oh, she's having a baby at the climax to create more drama or anything.
She's not prevented from doing anything for the most part by her being pregnant.
I mean, she doesn't go off on adventures with them, but there wasn't really a reason for her to. She packs them away and then, I assume, just sits on a couch reading books about Reiki or whatever.
There's also the fact that it's very much established that Pacha is the much more level-headed of the two, and that's why Pacha is going to see the Emperor as opposed to Chicha. There are probably a couple nitpicks that I'm going to toss at the film.
For each nitpick, I'm going to throw in a funny thing.
Perfect. There is this not-so-subtle through-line of ageism throughout the film that Yzma is incapable of doing her job or doing anything because she happens to be old and has wrinkles. You're getting it two ways with the ageism, but also the beauty standards because she happens to be a woman, and it is very subtly shitty.
It's a holdover from the earlier version where she was going to blot out the sun for immortality and all that jazz, and I wish it wasn't as much of a thing. Although, on the flip side, it does give us this recurring thing where characters will independently describe her as being
scary beyond all reason,
which is fair.
It's also not really well established that Cusco's change of heart and character growth are genuine. He doesn't really do a whole lot to earn Pacha's renewed trust and willingness to help. I understand why Pacha does it. Pacha's just a really good person. It's firmly established throughout the film.
Yeah, he's a good man.
But Cusco does very little to deserve that. By the end of the film, I don't necessarily feel that his change of heart is 100% believable.
It's true. It's a comedy, so I'm not as concerned if it was supposed to be more of a straight drama. But yeah, that could have had maybe like an extra minute given to it. It does, however, give us a great line where he's apologizing to a man he had defenestrated at the start of the film. And this guy is like about as old as Yzma. And the guy says,
"Oh, it's not the first time I was tossed out a window, and it won't be the last. What can I say? I'm a rebel."
I do have a nitpick, although that's mostly just that because of the changes to the plot, we don't get to hear Yzma's villain song, which is truly phenomenal.
There's a lot that the whole rewrite process to get this film done on time left out. I'm a little curious to see what would have happened if they were able to get the extension that they asked for.
Yeah, although I think what we got was still pretty good, about as good as it was going to be.
Mm-hmm. Although having a sort of Prince and the Pauper plot with Owen Wilson as David Spade's peasant double would have been interesting.
Yeah, this film does not need Owen Wilson.
No, I don't think it needs Owen Wilson, but for the plot that they were going for, Owen Wilson would have been a fine choice.
That's true.
It's really difficult to judge what was originally intended for this film and what we got. They are very, very different. The rewrite and restructuring of this film is massive. And it's actually really impressive how well this movie works, considering that it was a race to the finish line in the last 6 months.
I think the throw it all in, cobble it all together nature of the production probably led to a lot of the shrug, it just happened that way things. The how did Yzma and Kronk beat them there? It doesn't matter. That they didn't feel the need to answer that because they were just having fun with the whole thing and it wound up working out for them. It could have easily gone too far one way or the other and gone really badly.
Although if you do want to hear my reason for that, you can check out a Twitter thread that I posted earlier this week.
Yeah. I was like, oh, cool, Shaggy did some pre-reading, but no, you just came up with that. I'm really impressed with it.
So I think it's time to render our final decision.
While these are both really good films, and while I think that Emperor's New Groove has some higher highs, I think 101 Dalmatians is consistently a better film overall.
I would tend to agree. I loved 101 Dalmatians as a child. It's the film that got me to learn how to work a VCR so I could rewind the tape myself. But due to some of the
nickel and dimes?
Yeah, the nickel and dime stuff with Emperor's New Groove, the lack of Latinx representation, the low-key stuff, it brought down just enough to where I think 101 Dalmatians is a just slightly better film.
It's also definitely mood dependent. There are definitely times when I would rather watch Emperor's New Groove than 101 Dalmatians.
Oh yeah, definitely. 101 Dalmatians is not a superbly funny film, but it is enjoyable. Like I said, it's really difficult to watch that film and not have warm fuzzies by the end.
Mm-hmm. Whereas Emperor's New Groove is a really good, a party's winding down, we want to put something on while some of us are falling asleep and we're finishing off the last of the pizza kind of film, as opposed to 101 Dalmatians, which is more of a like a date film or a watch this with your kids kind of film.
So that's our decision for this week. Next week, we'll be discussing 1999's Tarzan and 2014's Big Hero 6. We also have a special surprise for you next week. You'll have to tune in to find out what it is. But once again, we'd like to thank you all for listening. If you want to make sure to keep up with us, you can follow us on our Podbean website. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You should be able to just search Gratuitous Pausing and find us in each of those locations.
Share stuff with your friends. And also, if there's other Disney movies that you would like us to talk about, throw that at us.
So, once again, thank you all, and we will catch you next time on the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. Cruella de Vil, Cruella de Vil. If she doesn't scare you, no evil thing will.
We're keeping all that.